The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, thanks for the kind introduction. Thanks for this incredible turnout. Thanks for quoting the review from the Washington Post as opposed to the review from the New York Times, which said that the book was awful. But it was interesting because, I mean, if you're me, you sort of think you've arrived, even have your book noticed by the New York Times. But truthfully, the review didn't matter. And it really makes you wonder what's the dynamic that leads people to notice books or pick up books. And it's, as far as I'm concerned, it turns out it's not the New York Times, for whatever, which is good. Here's what I thought I would do. I think we have an hour or so together. I like to speak fairly briefly in these events because I've come to believe that you much prefer to have the opportunity for give and take rather than just listen to somebody like me blather on. So I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes, despite the fact that it is a big day, I think, or an interesting day at least, with regard to the U.S. War in Iraq. I'm actually going to talk mostly about Afghanistan, which has been, apart from the events of the last 24 hours, much more in the news. However, when I finish, we can talk about whatever you want to talk about. Now, I have been warned that, maybe you know this because you come to these things, but I gather that there's mics that get passed around for the questions. And so I'm supposed to identify a person to ask a question. You have to wait for the mic to get to you. So if I don't remember to say that again, that's the rule that we're supposed to adhere to. So preliminaries done, book talk, all right? The title of my talk is, the title is not the title of the book. The title of the talk is Coming Home from Helmand, referring to the Helmand province in Afghanistan, but also I think probably largely referring to my sense that the time is long since past when America needs to come home in a broader sense. So here's the talk. History, I have come to believe this and I believe it passionately. History deals rudely with the pretensions of those who presume to determine its course. In an American context, this describes the fate of those falling prey to what we might call the Wilsonian conceit. Yet the damage done by that conceit outlives its perpetrators. From time to time, in some moment of peril or anxiety, a statesman appears on the scene, promising to eliminate tyranny, to ensure the universal triumph of liberty, and to achieve permanent peace. For a moment, the statesman achieves the status of prophet, one who in his own person seemingly embodies the essence of the American purpose. Then reality intrudes, exposing the promises as costly fantasies. The prophet's followers abandon him. Mocked and reviled, he is eventually banished, perhaps to some gated community in Dallas. Yet however brief his ascendancy, the discredited prophet leaves behind a legacy. Most obvious are the problems created and left unresolved, commitments made and left unfulfilled, debts accrued and left unpaid. Less obvious, but for that reason more important, are changes in perception. The prophet recasts our image of reality. Long after his departure, remnants of that image linger and retain their capacity to beguile. Consider how the Wilsonian vision of the United States as crusader state called upon to redeem the world, has periodically resurfaced despite Woodrow Wilson's own manifest failure to make good on that promise. The prophet declaims and departs. Yet traces of his testimony, however at odds with reality, remain lodged in our consciousness. So it is today with Afghanistan. The conflict that George W. Bush began, then ignored, and finally bequeathed to his successor. Barack Obama has now embraced that conflict as, in his words, the war we must win. Bush might rightly view Obama's enthusiasm for pressing on in Afghanistan as a form of vindication. Here we have a president, our current president, whose run for high office derived its energy from an implicit promise to repudiate all that Bush had wrought, now endorsing the proposition that this remote, landlocked, primitive Central Asian country constitutes a U.S. vital national security interest. The candidate who once derided the notion that the United States is called upon to determine the fate of Iraq now expresses a willingness to expend untold billions, not to mention who knows how many American lives, in order to determine the fate of Afghanistan. What is it about Afghanistan, possessing next to nothing that the United States requires, that justifies such lavish attention? In Washington, this question goes not only unanswered, but unasked. Among Democrats and Republicans alike, Afghanistan's importance is simply assumed. Much the way 50 years ago, otherwise intelligent people simply assumed that the United States had a vital interest in ensuring the preservation of South Vietnam. Yet as then, so too today, the assumption does not stand up to even casual scrutiny. The fight in Afghanistan is essential to keeping America safe, we are told. The events of September 11, 2001 ostensibly occurred because we ignored Afghanistan. Preventing the recurrence of these events, therefore, requires that we fix the place. This widely accepted line of reasoning overlooks the primary reason why the 9/11 conspiracy succeeded, namely that federal, state, and local agencies responsible for commercial aviation failed to install even minimally adequate security measures. We weren't paying attention. Consumed with its ABC agenda, remember ABC, anything but Clinton? Consumed with its ABC agenda, the Bush administration in those days did not have its eye on the ball. So we got sucker punched. Averting another 9/11 does not require the semi-permanent occupation and pacification of Afghanistan. Rather, it requires that the United States erect and maintain robust defenses. Fixing Afghanistan is not only unnecessary, it's also likely to prove implausible. Not for nothing has the place acquired the nickname Graveyard of Empires. Of course, Americans, insistent that the dominion over which they preside does not meet the definition of empire, evince little interest in how others have fared in attempting to impose their will on the Afghans. As General David McKiernan, until recently the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, put it, quote, "There's always an inclination to relate what we're doing with previous nations." And he went on to add, "I think that's a very unhealthy comparison." Now, McKiernan was expressing here a view common among the ranks of the political and military elite. We're Americans. We're different. Therefore, the experience of others does not apply. Of course, Americans like McKiernan, who reject as irrelevant the experience of others, might at least be willing to contemplate the experience of the United States itself. Take the case of Iraq. Now, bizarrely portrayed in some quarters as a success, and even more bizarrely seen as offering a template for how to turn Afghanistan around. 6+ years after it began, 6+ years after it began, Operation Iraqi Freedom has consumed something like $1 trillion. Nobody really knows for sure. With the meter still running, and has taken the lives of over 4,300 American soldiers. I mean, the evening before the highly touted turnover of the cities to the Iraqi security forces, 4 Americans were killed in action in Baghdad. Meanwhile, in Baghdad and in other major Iraqi cities, I believe it was Kirkuk today, car bombs continued to detonate at regular intervals, killing and maiming dozens. Given the embarrassing but indisputable fact that this was an utterly needless war, no weapons of mass destruction found, no ties between Saddam Hussein and the jihadists established, no democratic transformation of the Islamic world touched off, no road to peace in Jerusalem found in downtown Baghdad. To describe Iraq as a success, much less as a model for application elsewhere, falls nothing short of being obscene. The great unacknowledged lesson of Iraq is the one that the writer Norman Mailer identified years ago. Quote, "Fighting a war to fix something works about as good as going to a whorehouse to get rid of a clap." Now, for those who, despite this, still hanker to have a go at nation building, why start with Afghanistan? Why not first fix, say, Mexico? In terms of its importance to the United States, our southern neighbor, a major supplier of oil and drugs, among other commodities deemed vital to the American way of life, certainly Mexico outranks Afghanistan by several orders of magnitude. And for those who purport to believe that moral considerations rather than self-interest should inform foreign policy, there too Mexico qualifies for priority attention. Consider the theft of California. Or consider more recently how the American appetite for illicit drugs and our liberal gun laws have corroded Mexican institutions and produced an epidemic of violence affecting ordinary Mexicans. We owe these people big time. Yet any politician or pundit suggesting that the United States ought to commit 60,000 or so U.S. troops, backed by a generously funded multi-year effort with expectations of eliminating Mexican drug trafficking and political corruption, would be laughed out of Washington. And rightly so. Any proposal that the United States should take on the task of establishing in Mexico City effective mechanisms of governance, of endowing Mexico with competent security forces, of reforming the Mexican school system, of protecting the rights of Mexican women. Well, anybody proposing these things in Congress, well, they'd never get their proposal to the floor of the House or the Senate for a vote. Meanwhile, those who promote such programs for Afghanistan, ignoring questions of cost, and ignoring as well the corruption and the ineffectiveness that pervade our own institutions, well, those people get treated like sages. The contrast between Washington's preoccupation with Afghanistan and its relative indifference to Mexico testifies to the distortion of U.S. national security priorities induced by George W. Bush in his post-9/11 prophetic mode. Distortions now being perpetuated by Bush's successor. It also testifies to a vast failure of imagination to which our governing classes have succumbed. This failure of imagination makes it literally impossible for those who possess either authority or influence in Washington to consider the possibility, A, that the solution to America's problems is to be found not out there, where there in this case is Central Asia, but here at home. B, that the people out there, rather than requiring our administrations, may well be capable of managing their own affairs, relying on their own methods. And finally, C, that to disregard A and B is to open the door to great mischief, and in all likelihood to perpetrate no small amount of evil. Now, needless to say, when mischief or evil does occur, when a stray American missile kills a few dozen Afghan civilians, for instance, the costs of that failure of imagination are not borne by the people who inhabit the leafy neighborhoods of Northwest Washington, who lunch at the Palm restaurant, and who send their kids to Sidwell Friends. So the answer to the question of the hour, what should the United States do about Afghanistan, comes down to this. A sense of realism and a sense of proportion should oblige us to take a minimalist approach. As with Uruguay, or Fiji, or Estonia, or other countries where U.S. interests are limited, the United States should undertake to secure those interests at the lowest possible cost. What does this mean in practice? General David Petraeus, the commander of the United States Central Command, recently commented that, quote, the mission is to ensure that Afghanistan does not again become a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda and other transnational extremists. And he went on to expand on that a bit by saying that the mission was, quote, to deny them safe havens in which they can plan and train for such attacks. This mission statement is a sound one. The current approach to accomplishing the mission is not sound, and indeed qualifies as counterproductive. Denying Al-Qaeda safe havens has not required the United States to occupy the frontier regions of Pakistan, and it should not require the United States and its allies to occupy the entirety of Afghanistan. The reality is that as long as we maintain adequate defenses, Al-Qaeda poses no more than a modest threat to U.S. national security. Yes, a threat, but a modest threat. As for the Taliban, unless and until they manage to establish enclaves in places like New Jersey or Miami, the threat posed by the Taliban to the United States will fall several notches below the threat posed by Cuba, which is no threat at all. As for the putatively global threat posed by this thing called violent Islamic radicalism, well, that project will almost certainly prove to be a self-defeating one. Think about it. What the Islamists have on offer, which comes down to a rejection of modernity, it doesn't sell. As recent events in Iran, I would say, have vividly demonstrated. Like it or not, the ethos of consumption and individual autonomy will conquer the Muslim world as surely as it conquered what was once known as Christendom. It's the wreckage that the collapse of Christendom has left in its wake that demands our attention. If the United States today has a saving mission, It is to save itself. Speaking in the midst of another unnecessary war back in 1967, Martin Luther King got it exactly right when he said, "Come home, America." The prophet of that era, who urged his countrymen to take on what he called the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism, he remains the prophet today that we ignore at our peril. That Barack Obama should fail to realize this qualifies as not only ironic, but also inexplicable. So with that, I'll stop, and I look forward to any questions and comments that you may have. Thank you. And my watch says we got about 35 minutes for questions, so that's good. In the center, in the red dress, yes, ma'am. You're making it difficult because you sat in the middle, and it's hard to get you the microphone. So,
I agree that we should never have been there. Assuming that the President and Congress agreed with you and said, we're getting out of there, what advice would you give them as to the removal and transport home of the troops and all of the paraphernalia that the Americans have brought with them so that it can be done in a strategic, peaceful, and smart way?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be glib about it, but I don't think that's the hard part. I mean, I would call General McChrystal on the phone. I'd say, "General McChrystal, this is the boss speaking. Your mission has changed. Get back to me in the next couple of weeks and tell me how you are going to draw down the U.S. military presence, how long it's going to take, and tell me how you're going to give us some reasonable assurance that we're not going to be abandoning large quantities of very expensive equipment. Just give me your plan, General." And I would say I have a high level of confidence that General McChrystal could put together that plan. Now, I wouldn't tell McChrystal and have the last guy out of the theater in the next 45 minutes or the next 45 days. It would have to be done over a period of time. And frankly, I would want to defer to my commander to tell me what the reasonable amount of time was, as long as I was sure he wasn't playing with me in some way. I think the more difficult question is, were you to draw down the U.S. presence, then what approach would you take to ensure, to accomplish that mission of ensuring that Afghanistan doesn't become a safe haven for al-Qaeda cells planning terrorist attacks? And there my answer, the thing I would at least want to explore, would be the following course of action. It's a course of action that assumes, I think this assumption is correct, we'd want to test it, that assumes that the political tradition of Afghanistan is one that is not based on the idea of central governance with effective political authority being exercised from Kabul that reaches to the far perimeter of the entire country. Rather, that the political tradition of Afghanistan is a decentralized one in which effective authority is exercised by people who we can, if we're being kind about it, call tribal leaders or tribal chieftains. If we're not being kind about it, we say they're warlords. But they're the people who are in charge. What we would want to do is to try to provide incentives to those people to govern their little patch of ground in ways consistent with our interests. In other words, pay them to keep al-Qaeda out. Now, I would not work on the assumption that the people I was paying were trustworthy. I would work on the assumption that the people I was paying were untrustworthy, and therefore I would want to maintain a very intensive, I think, surveillance of Afghanistan, and I would reserve the prerogative of punishing those who violated that agreement. I mean, if Warlord X is indeed allowing the Taliban to take up residence in his area, then X gets punished, and Al-Qaeda gets punished. That's the approach I would at least take. Could I guarantee absolutely, positively, for sure that would work? No. I have a high level of confidence, though, it would work reasonably well and would cost us far, far, far less than the current approach is costing us. Yes, sir, on the aisle, about five rows back. Six.
My question is comparison with the Johnson administration. People are already talking about how, like Johnson, Obama has gotten, shall we say, overwhelmed by his lack of military experience, political experience, and is very much the captive, shall we say, of a way of thinking that maybe you alluded to in your talk. But how deep does this go in terms of your knowledge of Washington?
How valid is that comparison? Well, my sense would be that President Obama, I can say anything I want, I've never met the man, right? My sense is that President Obama, like President Johnson, views his purpose primarily in the context of domestic reform. And my sense would be that his definition of his purpose is not simply to get us out of this economic crisis, but really to make some pretty fundamental structural changes in the way our domestic political economy works so that he'll not only, if he succeeds, restore prosperity, but make prosperity sustainable. And that's how he will be famous. Johnson thought the way he would be famous was by completing the New Deal with his Great Society plan. And, of course, Vietnam War hijacked the Johnson presidency, destroyed the Johnson presidency, put an end to his domestic reform program. Is this going to happen again with President Obama? I have to say, because I think President Obama is head and shoulders the smartest politician we've seen in the last, 30, 50 years. And not only smart, but he really seems to be a incredibly shrewd person. And I am perplexed by his willingness to sort of take up the banner of Afghanistan. I don't understand why he would not be sensitive to the risks of having that war hijack his presidency and therefore torpedo his domestic reform agenda. I simply don't understand that. My speculation would be the following. This is speculation based on no empirical evidence, right? That he says to himself, for me to get done everything I want to get done, I need to be a two-term president. For me to be a two-term president, in other words, to be elected, reelected in 2012, I need to fix I need to restore prosperity. If I don't restore prosperity, I'm not going to get reelected. Therefore, I need to give myself some space to focus on domestic affairs. And the way to do that, in a sense, is in the near term, go along with the conventions of U.S. foreign policy or of U.S. national security policy. Or to put it another way, to avoid giving my political opponents ammunition to attack me as a national security wimp. And in order to do that, given that I ran as the anti-Iraq war president, in order to not be seen as a national security wimp, I'll make Afghanistan Obama's war, hoping that it won't unravel. And then after I'm reelected in 2012, most of my domestic reform agenda is done. At that point, I then focus on reshaping U.S. national security policy. Now, I find that plausible, but again, it's just sort of me making it up. Yes, ma'am, right here, in the third row, two off the aisle.
Well, don't we really have a much more complicated history in Afghanistan? after the amount of money and effort that Charlie Wilson put into Afghanistan, and the money and the equipment all went to the Mujahideen, if I'm saying it correctly.
Mujahideen, yes.
Would you say how that complicates our efforts to do anything?
Well, I mean, what you're referring to, of course, is that in the aftermath of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, right? So much time has gone. 79. First Jimmy Carter on a relatively small scale, then a Ronald Reagan on a much, much larger scale, helped by people like the King of Saudi Arabia and Margaret Thatcher, funded a very aggressive program of support for indigenous Afghan resistance fighters to try to defeat the Soviet occupation. And after a 10-year effort, it succeeded. And this was perceived, as still is perceived by many people, as one of the great victories of, one of the great successes of U.S. national security policy, because, by golly, we defeated the Soviets. But I think what you're alluding to is there's no question that the effect here went well beyond simply defeating Soviets. It destabilized Afghanistan, and it helped to persuade a generation of Islamist resistance fighters that they had the capacity to bring down a superpower. They did it once, and they figured they could do it again. So, yes, to some degree, the problem is one to which we ourselves contributed. Now, my sort of beat is relatively recent U.S. foreign policy. So my sort of focus on post-World War II for the most part. And I have to say, the more I think about it, read about it, the more I'm able to distance myself from some mythic notions of U.S. foreign policy to which I adhered as a young man, the more I'm impressed by the way that everything kind of fits together. I mean, let's take as another example Iran. You know, perceived by many in the United States, particularly many in Washington, as this as part of the axis of evil. You know, this regime, this sort of irrational regime that has this grudge against the United States. What the hell is their problem? And we are oblivious as a people to the larger context and the fabric of U.S.-Iranian relations over the past half century. I mean, I dare say that if we just sort of walk down the streets of Philadelphia and ask the average Philadelphian if they could tell us anything about U.S.-Iranian relations, let's just pick some arbitrary year, 1953. Anything happened in 1953? What are you talking about? I dare say if you walked down the streets of Tehran and asked 100 people about that, they'd say, every one of them would say, well, that is the year that the CIA collaborated with MI6 to overthrow a democratically elected government and reinstall the Shah. Well, there are dots that go from 1973 to 1979 and the hostage crisis, through the 1980s when we supported Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, down to the present moment when, yes, I imagine the Iranians are trying to develop a nuclear weapon. I mean, cripes, if you were the national security advisor to President Ahmadinejad, who is a nut, if you were the national security advisor, would you favor developing an Iranian nuclear weapon? You're darn tootin' you would. Because you'd perceive, and understandably perceive, the United States of America as posing a serious threat. And you would also cast your eyes over to the Korean Peninsula and you would take a look at what happens when a dictatorial regime gets a nuclear weapon. And what happens, and suddenly you have deference and respect, which is much of what the North Koreans have managed to carve out in their own weird way. So, yeah, it's a bigger story. And unfortunately, we Americans tend not to have a lot of interest in that context that you referred to. Yes, sir, in a blue shirt, about seven rows back.
I took a glance at your book before the talk began. You seem to have ambitions that, and you addressed it at the end of your talk.
Ambitions?
About understanding the deeper roots of American policy and American exceptionalism. That's what the book seems to be partly about.
Right.
So, and you ended your talk by saying what we're going to do at home.
What
we ought to do at home, in your view. So why don't you spell that out for us a little? Where do we go domestically?
Because then you won't buy the book.
No. Oh, no, no, no. I've already bought it, so you've gotten at least one customer already. I'm taking a chance because I've already read one of your other books. If it's supposed to be a tease, then I'll ask it in a different way. What's the use of American power in the world constructively? We appear to be the threat to other people rather than on a receiving end. So do we have to learn our own history better so we remember what we did to other people that they haven't forgot that we did to them and they still hold a grudge some years later? And is there a constructive use for our policy, say in the Middle East with Israel and the Palestinians, in the way that we could influence the outcome of Israel's policy by the money we lend them, by the cover we give for what they do, by the pressure we could put on them and the Palestinians? Would we have constructive use for our power that didn't require the expenditure of a lot of money?
I think the answer is no, no, and yes. But let me expand a little bit, because you asked about five questions. I'm trying to figure out how to approach. I don't want to dodge you at all. I've come to believe, and this is a belief that I think many people would not particularly agree with, and it reflects the fact that I am a conservative, right? I don't mean a George Bush, Dick Cheney conservative. I mean a real conservative. That there is a fundamental cultural crisis that has enveloped the country over roughly the last 50 years. And the cultural crisis is not something that necessarily has adversely affected every individual in this auditorium, but I do believe it has adversely affected the great majority of our fellow citizens, and the adverse effect is that we have come to embrace a distorted and unsustainable notion of what it means to be free. The freedom for too many Americans has come to mean basically conspicuous consumption and radical individual autonomy. That freedom is not in particular tethered to some sort of individual understanding of what is true and lasting and permanent. And this is a big problem. And the manifestation of that problem, I think, is all around us in ways that we have come to sort of take for granted and almost view as a joke. You know, the consumption, the culture of shop till you drop, dependence upon foreign energy with very little consideration of the consequences of that independence, of that dependence, rather, and so on. So one point would be that if you were surveying the landscape, and say, what are the two or the three or the four things that we as a people really need to focus on to worry about? I think the health of our culture ranks way ahead of the Taliban. So that'd be point number one. Point number two is, yes, with regard to U.S. foreign policy, I've increasingly come to believe that, although it is not that everything that every statesman since FDR has done has been wrong and stupid and reckless and a failure, that would be way too strong, that there have been an unacceptable number of failures and misjudgments that have cost us very dearly. The Iraq War is a recent example. The Vietnam War is another, even larger example. Over the course of this period of U.S. foreign policy, post-World War II, one of the things that strikes me that, again, we've just simply come to, it's become part of the wallpaper of this country, we don't even notice it. One of the things that's happened is the extent to which U.S. foreign policy has become militarized. I mean, in the book I'm working on right now, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about what I call the sacred trinity. The sacred trinity is the concrete expression of American so-called global leadership. And the sacred trinity, three items. One, that the United States must maintain a global military presence. Two, that the United States configures its forces not to defend the United States of America, but for purposes of global power projection. And number three, given this presence, given this capacity for projection, number three is a penchant for interventionism, overt and covert. That's what we do. And we have lost our ability, first of all, just to recognize the existence and the significance of the Sacred Trinity. We've also lost our ability to evaluate whether the gal dang thing makes sense. Does it make us safer? Is it guaranteeing our abundance? Is it guaranteeing our freedoms? I'm increasingly persuaded that the answer is no. That it's undermining our abundance. It's compromising our freedom. But I don't think we particularly notice it. You asked, are there ways to use American power positively? Well, yes, of course. American power has been used positively. I mean, the Marshall Plan was a stroke of great genius. The creation of NATO in 1949 was a necessary step. Why the hell NATO still exists today with our presence, I have no idea. In 1949, it was a wise and important thing to do. So, yes, it's possible to use our power. It's not possible to use our power to remake the world in America's image. Now, is it possible to use our power, just got to the last part of your question, to sort out the Israeli-Palestinian mess? And I have to tell you, my answer is no. I mean, I think the argument that I hear expressed from time to time kind of goes like this. Geez, we give the Israelis $3 billion a year in various kinds of assistance. I think mostly security assistance these days. So clearly that gives us a lot of leverage. Why don't we just use that leverage and say, look, either you're going to do what we tell you to do, I'm overstating it, or we're not going to give you the $3 billion a year. I have to say what I think they would say in response is, shove it up your nose. Now, why would they say that? They would say that, first of all, because they have a radically different view of the prerequisites of Israeli national security than we do. I mean, I'm not an Israeli. I'm not Jewish. All right? I am an American, and I believe profoundly that we have a vital national security interest in solving the Palestinian problem. But I can empathize with the Israelis, with Jewish Israelis, in light of the history of the Jews, in light of the history of Israel over the last 60 years, I can understand why they would be a little bit reluctant to say, oh, yeah, sure, let's create this nation state right next to us, and I'm sure we'll live in peace and harmony. Moreover, let us not forget the Israeli trump card. And the Israeli trump card is the Israeli nuclear arsenal. The Israeli nuclear arsenal exists, I believe, primarily not to serve as a threat or deterrent vis-a-vis the Arabs and the Iranians. I think that the principal purpose for the Israeli nuclear arsenal is to make sure that we won't abandon them. The ultimate threat that the Israelis have, the leverage they have on us is, go ahead, abandon us like the Jews have always been abandoned, you Americans. But understand, we're not going to go down without a fight. Understand, we have the capacity to blow up the whole friggin' Middle East. And it is that, I think, concern, prospect, that makes it all that much more difficult and unlikely that we would try to use the leverage that some people believe that we have. And I say that with, I mean, it makes me very sad to say that, because I see no resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And many of you know that there are a variety of demographic factors that are sort of in play that, in fact, are going to add further layers of complication to the situation that already exists over roughly the next 20 or 30 years. And I this is one of these things where I just feel like we're on some arc of tragedy where nobody has the answer. Yes, sir. And
what do you like about being an? What do you like about being an American?
What do I like about it? Mm-hmm. Oh man! I like the values in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. I like the fact that I can come to Philadelphia and say whatever I want to say and engage in a dialogue with people. I love the fact that I, as to be a university professor is a truly a privileged position. I get paid pretty good money. I get to teach young people, which is a tremendously stimulating profession. And when I'm not teaching, they let me do whatever the hell I want to do, and that allows me to write. So I think that the freedom that I am permitted is, well, it's just something that I cherish very much. Yes, ma'am. Okay, well, after this one, we'll go in the back, because all the people in the back are getting mad.
Do you think it's going to be possible for Obama to listen to some of the more peace-oriented people? And if so, what should we be doing to get him to listen?
No, I don't think he will listen. I mean, I think that's when I was trying to describe the sacred trinity, this consensus, I think, again, I'm not expecting that everybody would sort of buy this, believe it, but my own view is that this national security consensus, this belief that global leadership, which we feel that we are called upon to exercise, nobody else can do it, this belief that global leadership requires a global military presence and global power projection and a pattern of interventionism is something that the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats subscribe to. I mean, let's think about the election of the 2008. I don't mean Obama versus McCain, but the entire long, drawn-out primary season leading up to their nomination. There were two candidates who stood outside that consensus. There was one on the left, and there was one on the right. Who was the one on the left? Kucinich. Who was the one on the right? Ron Paul. How many votes did they get? Zippo. Matter of fact, it wasn't that they got simply they got Zippo. Maybe this is a little bit unfair, but my sense is that each guy's party treated him as if he had some kind of dread disease. You know, we don't want to get too close to Dennis Kucinich. We're going through the motions of letting him be on the platform, but oh my God. And both of these guys were sort of treated by the media as, you know, not quite jokes, but not someone whose views should be taken seriously because they were outside that consensus. So for peace and justice groups to have an opportunity to, I think, really have their voice heard, they have to crack that consensus. Again, speaking as a historian, and I've been thinking a lot about this lately because of what I've been writing on. You know, when I was I served in Vietnam toward the end of the war, 70 to 71. And I'm not sort of, you know, dramatic war stories, but it was a pivotal event in my young life. And I certainly believed then, and I suppose I believe now, that was one of the pivot points of contemporary American history, the Vietnam War, and everything about it, the war itself, the opposition, and so on. And yet, when you think about it, with regard to national security policy, what's striking about Vietnam is how brief and trivial its effects were. I mean, Saigon falls in 75. By 1980, 5 years later, I mean, that's a blink in history. We have elected Ronald Reagan president. We've elected Ronald Reagan president because Ronald Reagan is the guy that says, by God, we need to rebuild American military power. By 1990-91, with Operation Desert Storm, the brief reluctance to intervene is swept aside. Remember George Herbert Walker Bush's famous comment in 1991, well, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome, which was quite true. I mean, the lid comes off of interventionism from 1991 going forward. So in my point of that sort of narrative is to suggest how difficult it is going to be to get people to question the consensus, how difficult it is going to be to have somebody who runs for high office, who stands outside that consensus, and still get them to be treated respectfully and as a serious contender for power. It's just a steep hill, I think. So, yes, sir, all the way in the back next to the door. Two more questions.
In the 1950s, President Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex. A lot of what you alluded to as far as the loss of democracy, don't you think it did come to fruition?
Well, yes and no. I'm always a little bit wary about talking about the military-industrial complex because I mean this directed at you personally, but I think there's a lot of people who want to find a simple answer to our troubles. And the military-industrial complex is an example of a simple answer. You know, it's this, in essence, I know you didn't say this, you know, in essence, it's this dark, shadowy conspiracy and these people hijack our policy and there we are, innocent Americans being taken advantage of. I think that way overstates the case, and the problem, of course, is if you blame the military-industrial complex, then you're sort of saying, it's not my fault. And going back to my point about a cultural crisis, I think in many respects, if you're not happy with foreign policy, most of us need to own up to the fact that we own a piece of what we're not happy with. The second thing, though, also is that although it's absolutely true that if you're looking at the percentage of discretionary spending on the part of the federal government, the defense budget's still a big chunk. I mean, defense spending this year is somewhere around, again, nobody knows, probably somewhere around $650 to $700 billion. Having said that, defense spending is actually far, far, far less significant, either as a proportion of the economy or as an overall part of federal spending than it was back when Eisenhower was leaving the presidency. We are only spending about 4% of GDP on defense right now. I think during the Cold War, the average was 10% of GDP. I was just reading something earlier this morning. In 1946, right after World War II, the defense budget was 36% of the federal budget. So the point would be, yes, the military-industrial complex is important. Number two, it's not as influential, I think, as it once was in terms of clout. Number three, it's really not, I think, a proper explanation for our problems. It's a bigger explanation required. I have not done a good job of gender balance, and I would like to ensure that the last question was asked by a woman. Well, preferably one in the back, but there's none in the back. So, yes, ma'am, right here. You have to wait for your microphone.
You reenacted a John Stewart scenario earlier when you did sort of a man on the street. What do we know about Iran, and what do the people on the street know about us? And, of course, we knew nothing, and people on the street in Iran knew unbelievable things about American history.
Who's funnier, him or me?
Him.
In other words, don't quit my day job.
So I guess my and this week also I've been gifted by hearing a woman, Trudy Rubin, from the Inquirer, talk about education and education in the Middle East. And I guess my sense about Barack Obama is I pray that his domestic agenda, and I wonder what your thought as an educator is about this, that if we were all more informed about history and about other cultures, and if we spoke other languages, and if we had a greater understanding of our world, maybe we wouldn't be in the situation that we are in today.
I'm all for it, but I cannot help but be struck by the extent to which, for whatever reason, we tend to be a fairly provincial people. I also am struck by, I have to confess, we educators have a fairly limited effect on people. Not because I think we're lazy or stupid, but a person's outlook is shaped by a host of influences, and what you read for some course or what you hear in the classroom is only one influence among many. I teach courses in U.S. foreign policy, among other things. And there's one thing that the average BU student knows coming into one of my courses, you know, the average sort of 19-year-old young kid. One thing the kid knows about foreign policy, and that is that U.S. foreign policy breaks into two chapters. And chapter one goes from 1776 to, just to pick an arbitrary date, December 7th, 1941. And the label on chapter one is isolationism. And then there's chapter two. And chapter two is called global leadership. And I spend a whole semester just trying to bludgeon these kids into being open to the possibility that the story of the United States between 1776 and 1941, remember 1776, 13 little colonies, 1941, from sea to shining sea, that maybe something was going on during that interval other than isolationism. And we get to the end of the course, and I ask a question, and I ask, you know, the question, what do you think of isolationism? And then they will very conscientiously write down, isolationism is a myth. We learned that this, you know, and then they get their grade and they leave. And I think 15 minutes after they leave my course, they know that there's two chapters in the story of American foreign policy. Why is that? I don't know. This has really been terrific. I'm very grateful, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.